Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome everyone to the Really 007 podcast. I'm John Kell and we're here for this special interview with cinema legend John Richardson. John is an Oscar-winning special effects supervisor and designer who has been involved in over 100 movies, including 9 James Bond adventures. You can watch all our interviews on our YouTube channel, but you can listen to them and more on iTunes and Spotify and leave a lovely review if possible. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you'll find plenty of silly interactions between Bond fans all across the world. And with me today, we have esteemed Really 007 contributor Chris Goldie, who will be just as excited as I am to speak to John. So good afternoon, Chris.
Hi, good afternoon.
And John needs no introduction from us. He is the man responsible for creating so many of the magical moments that we cherish as Bond fans and fans of cinema in general. So welcome to the show. Thank you, Mr. John Richardson.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you with us. So you are a special effects legend, and we'd just love you to just share as a start just about how you got into the world of special effects and the influence that your dad had on this.
I got into films and special effects in particular in the time-honoured way, nepotism. My father started working in the film industry in 1921, just over 100 years ago. Consequently, I sort of grew up on visiting film sets and playing cowboys and Indians on Sherman tanks on Hollywood Common and being rowed in a small boat through Captain Hornblower's fleet of ships on a huge water tank at Denham Studios back in the 1950s. I remember it well because I got a splinter under my nail and I cried and cried and cried until the nurse brought me an ice cream to shut me up. But I hastened to add, I was very small at the time. So yeah, I started working on films because I used to go away on location with my father in my early teens. I was fortunate enough to spend 3 months in Israel when he was making Exodus for Otto Preminger. And I ended up with 3 jobs on the film. I worked for my father, helping do the special effects. I worked in accounts, helping them to sort out the invoices. And I had a very small walking part in the film as a kibbutz guard. So, you know, I started at quite a young age and then went on and went on location with him on movies like Lawrence of Arabia, which for me is still one of the best films ever made.
Absolutely.
It sort of grew from there. I couldn't wait to get out of school, you know, start work properly on films, which I did in 1962 on a film called The Victors, which had a huge cast, directed by Carl Foreman. And then went off to Malaya on a film with Bill Holden, there's Annie York and Capucine, directed by the wonderful Lewis Gilbert,
who I know
three or four films with. So, yeah, the life went on from there, really.
I mean, just in that minute alone, there was so much amazing information. I mean, to say that you worked with your dad on Lawrence of Arabia, I mean, that is such a special memory that just must be absolutely incredible. And
I mean, you know, you grow up with it, you tend to accept it as normal. Looking back on it, I realise how privileged I was.
Yeah.
As you do it through the years, I mean, you know, you work on a Bond film, you don't, I suppose, the first one you feel really lucky and pleased to be working on it. But after you've read the script and then you're then trying to figure out how to make a plane fly through a hangar or blow something up or do whatever's required, it becomes a job very quickly. You know, there's an awful lot of responsibility, worry, you know, budgets to adhere to, people to protect, safety, all the other.
Yeah.
And you're still trying to make it look fabulous on the screen. I like to think that I was fortunate and in working through what I regard as the golden age of movie making, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even the 90s, we didn't have huge crews. The budgets weren't vast like they are today. You know, if you wanted to use a crane on a set, it was, oh, God, how much is that going to cost? Now you drive past a film set anywhere, and there's five huge cranes out on the set holding the lights and doing whatever they're doing. And I think the other thing I'm probably more proud of than anything is that when we did it, we did it in camera. We didn't have CGI to paint wires out. We didn't have all the advantages that CGI can give you. Sadly, I think today it's so overused. It's making movies look a lot more like a cartoon than a real film. So I think films, for me anyway, have lost reality. And I really struggle to look at some of the comic character films that are made now, because they do look more like animation than a real movie.
Absolutely.
You know, everything we did, we had to figure out how we could do it in camera, either with a model or for real. If we used things on wires, we had to use really fine wires to be able to paint them out and light them out. You know, people, I don't think, realize back in those days that we used to paint the wires all different colors all the way up and down and work very closely with the cameraman to get him to put flags on the lights to tape the light off a can, off a wire, or put light on it. It was a completely different world. And, you know, even going back to the first Superman movie I did with Richard Donner, the best one, you know, we were flying Superman on very thin piano wires and having to paint them out because we didn't have CGI to paint them out afterwards. You know, a few years later on Cliffhanger, the visual effects people asked us to paint the wires with bright red paint so they could find them easily to paint them out, digitally take them out. What happened on Cliffhanger, because it was one of the early days of CGI, was we painted them all red, and then they had trouble getting them out. But, you know, the joys of movie making.
Like you say, there's the limitations of filmmaking, you know, that you can't always get what you want, so you have to come up with a creative solution, you know, whether it's a crane, whether it's, you know, like CGI, and whether it's you know, like approaching things in a practical sense rather than kind of, oh, well, we can just sort that out in post-production. I think for me, you see that in a lot of filmmaking now, yeah, where there is that, we'll just sort it in post. And it, and like you say, there's it feels less sort of like grounded in reality because it's constantly painting. You're painting over the cracks later on, yeah, or adding stuff. But like I say, to me, what's so exciting and what is so amazing when I look back at the particularly the films that you've worked on, is even it just as a, without even thinking about the practicalities of making something, they are awe-inspiring, absolutely, yes, amazing scenes. And then when you actually think about how did people actually create that, is even more mind-blowing. Like I say, I think that's the for me, that's the magic of cinema, is that you're not aware of it, but when you actually think about it, these are the greatest technicians, the greatest artists who are working in it. And I think that, yeah, I agree with you. I think that period where you worked is for me, is definitely a golden age of filmmaking, where there was also a lot of variety.
I mean, there were a couple of films, a couple of the Bond films that, you know, I'm most proud of. One was Octopussy. The other one was The Living Daylight.
Oh.
And we did foreground miniatures where we would put miniature sets in front of the real set and use the reality of the background, mm-hmm, in conjunction with the model, and people could never see the joins. They never realized that when the plane flies into the hangar on Octopussy, it was a model plane flying behind a model door, but it was in front of a real hangar, mm-hmm, with real actors and stuntmen and people, the plane going through the hangar.
I think it's certainly one of the greatest Bond pre-title sequences, isn't it? And that stunt is just, yeah, like I say, the effects. To hear the stories about it is...
Yeah, we'd love to hear it because it's just so much imagination. I mean, it's our childhood. It's our childhood, this. And you're right. I mean, I remember reading your book about how, you know, Corky Fornoff would offer him to fly through. And it was the idea, but no, you need people there. And there's no, like, CGI tricks. This is happening. And it's... It brings you so much more into the action because it's so realistic. Please just tell us about that experience of driving it through.
One thing that we worked out very quickly was the speed that Corky's plane would be flying and the length of the hangar. It would be in and out in less than a second. Well, that's not very exciting. I came up with this wild idea that we'd get an old Jaguar car, cut the roof off, weld a pole arm into the chassis in the middle, put a gimbal on the top of it with a full-size BD jet on it that could bank and move, and then paint the car and the pole camouflage colours, and I'd drive it through the hangar at 75 miles an hour, which gave us much longer screen time. You got actors and stuntmen running backwards and forwards, carefully positioned cameras so you didn't see me in the Jaguar. I drove through it, I say 75 miles an hour. I did it about five or six times. Stuntmen would be closing the doors at the far end up to a predetermined spot.
Yep.
So that as the plane banked, it just squeezed through the gap. Well, the gap, I think, gave me about 4 inches either side of the Jaguar at that speed. It was an interesting ride. The last take, in fact, I got out through the doors at the far end and the throttle had jammed open on the car. It took me a second to realise why I couldn't slow the wretched thing down. I ended up, of course, turning off the ignition. That, in turn, turned off the power steering. There's one of Her Majesty's planes parked on the far side of the grass, and I took to the grass heading towards it, ended up spinning the car to try and slow it down.
Fill her up, please.
But, you know, they're all sort of fun things and moments that you get doing a Bond, and, you know, it's every schoolboy's dream to get to play with the toys that we got to play with.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you file that under what the hell am I doing, or this is one of the best jobs in the world? You know? Well, somewhere in between.
It's the best job in the world afterwards when you're in the bar.
Yeah, and obviously the, you know, cars and planes and stuff was not the only thing, only car tricks you were doing in Octopussy. You were putting cars on train tracks as well, weren't you?
Follow that car.
Well, we had a car on the train track, which I had Joe Roger out to drive. Not that there was much involved in driving, but I found the first time you did it and you're coming up to a set of points, you desperately wanted to turn the steering wheel. Of course, that's the last thing you needed to do. But Roger was great. I mean, he sat in it and drove it, and he was quite happy with it. We had a lot of fun with that. You know, I mean, one of the other wilder moments was on Moonraker, when we had to do the Bond boat going over the waterfall in Iguazu. And I'd sort of inherited that whole section of the film. Got out to Iguazu, and the water blowing over the falls was pretty awesome. It was because it was winter. Yeah. It had rained a lot more. The water was very high, and we ended up having to walk the boat out. I mean, a couple of tons of Bond speedboat pushed by hand across half a mile of river, literally 100 yards up from the edge of the falls, which were 300-foot drop. And the water at times could vary anything between waist deep and over the top of your head, and it was flowing very fast. I'd warned the production beforehand that although we were happy to give it a go, I was concerned that the boat would get jammed on rocks where they wanted it to go over. But, you know, if they wanted me to go ahead, we'd do it. So we did. Two of us spent 2 days getting the boat out into the middle in position, and we'd literally wade and swim from rock to rock, rope together, and then I'd get onto a rock, fasten myself off, and Johnny, my assistant, would pay the rope and the boat out to me. I'd pull the boat across, and then he'd come across, and then we'd go to the next rock. And we got it into position to release, and released it, and the boat went right up to the edge of the falls and jammed on a rock. I mean, right on the edge. It was, well, half the boat was hanging over the edge, and the water was, I say, flowing extremely fast. The second unit director, Ernie Bay, said to me when we got back, well, we can't leave the boat there because we've got to shoot all the plates. Background plates, how are you going to move it for me? And I said, well, the only thing I can think of is if we go out with a helicopter, I've got a harness, lower me down on a winch and I'll try and push it over. Oh. So we tried that, and they kept dropping me in the water and in the bushes, and eventually I got on the rock that the boat was stuck on, and I couldn't move. It was far too heavy, and because the rock had pierced the bottom of the boat, the boat was half full of water as well. We went back to the airfield, and I said to the pilot, look, can you fly me out? Drop me down so I can get hold of the bars on the prow of the boat, and then you fly back over the edge of the falls with me acting as a link. I'll drag the boat until it's over the edge and then let go as it goes. Seemed like a good plan at the time. Anyway, the pilot then said, oh, well, I can't do that because the cargo lifting point will only hold 300 kilos. Not the cargo lifting point, sorry, the winch. So we then came up with the plan that I'd tie a rope to the cargo lifting point under the helicopter, put that on my harness, fly out there. They'd lower me down on the winch until I was hanging on the rope side, and we'd try it. And anyway, we got out there, and I eventually got hold of the front of the boat, and the helicopter's really straining, trying to pull us over. And strangely, all I could hear over the rotor noise was a very funny ping, ping, ping sound, which took me a few minutes to realise what it was. It was the stitching on my harness breaking.
Oh, my word.
With the tension. So I had to make a very quick decision. Do I hang on till it's all broken and stay with the boat, or do I let go and hope that there's enough stitches left to keep me under the helicopter? So I opted for the latter, and the rest is history. I'm still here.
So they got the idea for the opening of License to Kill.
Yeah.
Your very own Bond moment.
It's the sort of things happen, and you know, we do it all effects guys, and you know, we don't get extras like the stunt guys do. We just do it because we got to do it. But you know, moments like that sort of give you something to talk about in later.
I mean, it's unbelievable, John. I mean, you mentioned Moonraker. I know you were involved in the original Casino Royale, but Moonraker was your first foray into Eon Productions.
Yeah.
Was that because of your link with Lewis Gilbert that came about?
Well, I knew Lewis very well. I also knew Bill Cartledge, who was the first AD.
Yeah.
And I've worked with Bill on quite a few pictures. At the time on Moonraker, things weren't happening quite the way they wanted them to. Derek, who was in charge of the picture, was concentrating on the model work back at Pinewood, and there were concerns about the physical effects side of the film. So I think Bill and Lewis together suggested that they get me in to sort of take over some or all of it. I didn't want to tread on anybody's toes because I knew all the guys who were doing it. They'd all worked for me in the past. I tried to be diplomatic and say, look, I'll take over all the American side of the filming, which is, you know, out in South America and Iguazu and up in Miami. And, you know, I'm not silly. I choose the bit where the sunshine is. So.
You didn't want to go out to space now.
But it was good. And, you know, the boat chase was particularly, again, because we did it all for real explosions in the water, real speed boats, you know, radio-controlled torpedoes.
Wow.
It was, I say, you know, it's a schoolboy's dream.
Absolutely. Amazing.
So I know I'm flitting from one thing to another, but as I look through your book, one of the things that really strikes me is some of the gadgets that you were involved in creating and stuff, especially on Octopussy, the pen, the rope. And I'd just love you to tell us a bit. Yeah, I'd love you to tell us about some of the process of some of the gadgets that you've created and stuff.
You know, the Indian rope trick, we had to figure out how to make a rope go up in the air with somebody on it. And, you know, that's what I was talking about a few moments ago. We had to use very fine piano wires because of the scene where the rope's supposed to break at the bottom and fall with the guy on it. You know, the first part we could do with pneumatic rams and ropes going up and down through the floor. But to do the breaking one, we had to have a rope with a steel bar through the middle of it, a hinge at the point where it had to break. But to support it when it was going up with a man on it, we had to hang it on piano wire.
Fast.
Having problems keeping it up, Q?
Experimental model.
And I was testing it on the stage to check it out and got 10 feet up in the air and the wire broke, dumped me on my backside, spraining my ankle.
Oh dear.
It's one of the joys of trying things yourself. I mean, all we did was up the size of the piano wire, and I'm happy to say that the guy playing the part of the Indian on the rope was a lot lighter than me as well, which helped a lot.
Obviously, like, as well, you know, you were massively involved in creating the Zorin airships for A View to a Kill, and there's some amazing pictures in your book about actually filming that Golden Gate Bridge scene, and both Chris and myself and the rest of us at Really Double Seven, we adore A View to a Kill and think that the climax of that, all the way from Mayday's explosion all the way through to the Golden Gate Bridge, is just some of the greatest bits of cinema from the 80s we've seen. And you are so responsible for so much of it. And we'd just love you to tell us about the process, if that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the great thing about the Bonds also was collaboration. John Glenn was a great director to work with.
Yeah.
We knew one another very well. You know, the Bonds of crews are famously always a family.
Yeah.
And, you know, that came from Cubby originally. But, you know, we all knew one another and we collaborated really well. And there was never there was never allowed to be one prima donna department head thought their part was more important than everybody else's.
Wow.
And again, I think that's one of the reasons all those bonds showed up so well, is because...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You know, a good film isn't great effects or great lighting or great sound. It's great everything coming together.
Yeah.
You know, when you get a whole team's work allowed to join up and shine, that's what makes things into a good movie.
Yeah. And
working with John, you know, he'd sit down with a storyboard artist and do a first set of storyboards. We'd look through them and, you know, you come to some shots and you look at them and they say, well, can you do that? I say, yeah, you know, I can do it. But, you know, that one shot there is going to cost you $1 million. John used to say, well, look, you go and work with a storyboard artist, get him to do it the way you think, bring him back to me and we'll talk about it. And that collaborative ability, and it, you know, it wasn't just with me, it was all the others as well, but it allows you to figure out how you can, with cuts and models and foreground miniatures and everything, put a scene together.
Mm.
So, you know, we had, I think, three or four sizes of Zorin airship, apart from the full-size one. We had a tent scale one that floated across the top of the Golden Gate Bridge with San Francisco in the background. And that was a photographic cutout of San Francisco on the back lot of Pinewood with the real sky behind, with a model bridge in front of it, with a small balloon hanging from a crane over the top.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had a 20-foot airship that we could blow up with air or with helium or with hydrogen to blow it up. And the beauty of that was if we got shots looking over the top of the airship, we could fill it with helium and suspend it from the ground, so you didn't have any wires over the top. If you got shots underneath it, we could fill it with air and hang it from a crane with the wires on the top. So you've got the ability to safely hang it and control it, but at the same time, you were never that worried about losing the wires or painting them out. And it was, you know, lots of tricks like that. And we got away with things. I can remember that there was one shot where they're looking up as the balloon goes over the top in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I shot that with a real crowd of people and our model flying up high over the top of them. You know, you put it together with the right lens and the right scale, the right film speed, and you can make it look real. But, you know, it's all a balance. And, you know, again, on View to a Kill, there was the cavern scene where it floods. You know, we built a huge model of that because we couldn't quickly flood the real set, which filled 007 stage. So we had quite a big model, I think it was third or quarter full size, and I wanted to put real people in the model. So into a little section of the model, I cut a mirror to fit, and then we stood the actors behind the camera on a rostrum, reflected in the mirror. So you could look into, film the model, and there standing in the middle of it were real actors moving.
So fun.
And, you know, it's just having the toys and the ability to play with things like that and get it right. I mean, you know, you can't play for too long. You've got to be pretty sure of what you're doing because, you know, the purse isn't that deep, but it was great fun doing it.
So you like action movies and you love the stars who perform their own stunts, right? Okay, stop. That's not what this show is. We visit movies from the archive and explore the stunt performer's role in creating the magic you see on screen. We take a deep dive into the stunt itself and break it down so you can better understand how important the stunt performers are to big and small screen productions. Join me, John Aughty, every Wednesday for the podcast and every Friday for the YouTube episode. Action Movie Secrets every week when we go behind the stunts. Find it wherever you find your podcasts.
What kind of attributes does a great kind of special effects guy need? Like, you got collaboration, you've got, you know, being creative, being practical minded, being able to adapt. You know, is that you know, when you're looking, working with other people on the films, is that something that you're kind of looking for? And like, obviously, John Glenn was an editor, so I always feel it sounds like he has an editor's mind.
Yeah.
For a lay person, you know, when you hear about, you know, special effects, visual effects people who work on films, it's like, oh, well, it's very much a practical thing. It's like, oh, well, they just build things. It's just to do with, you know, a craft. But what your descriptions of what it's like to be on set, there's so much more creativity, you know, problem solving, you know, like shooting things at different angles. And like I say, constantly adapting. Is that kind of what you look for in other team, you know, people you work with?
I looked for people to do all the things I can't.
great answer.
You know, I've been very fortunate in that I've had great crews working for me. So I've had really good model makers. You know, I mean, my drawing ability sucks, but, you know, I've had people that can draw. People that can weld, you know, I can do a little bit. I'm a jack of all trades, master of one, I suppose, which is practical effects. But, you know, the scope that effects cover when you think about it, and this is why I think working with much smaller crews back in the 60s and 70s was far more challenging because, you know, I'd do films like The Devils or the Straw Dogs with Peckinpah with a crew of two of us or three of us.
Right.
You know, you learn to be creative. You learn to think on your feet. The one thing I always felt was always have a plan B. If you're doing a difficult effect or something that's really tricky that might go wrong, be able to say to the director in front of the crew, oh, it's all right, don't worry, we'll do this instead and it'll still work. You know, plan Bs have got me out of trouble on several occasions over the years. The scope of what we do, it covers electronics. Nowadays it covers, you know, computing, computer controls heavily, welding, machining, heavy engineering, light engineering, model making, explosives, how to deal with fire, how to deal with water, pumping, flotation, working underwater. You know, I've spent quite a number of hours in my life underwater. I did raise the Titanic. I think I logged 430 hours submerged.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just on that film. You know, the silly thing is that, you know, back in those days, you'd spend all this time underwater. I mean, I used to some days spend 6 hours actually underwater. you still had time to play practical jokes. I don't know, you just got on with it. We used to go down and take full bottles with us, and rather than go up to the surface to put a fresh bottle on, we used to change tanks on the bottom when one ran out.
Yeah.
You had to in those days, and I think that gave me and the crews that worked for me great grounding.
Mm.
And I say, you know, the ability to think on your feet and come up with ideas and plans. You know, I'm not saying everybody's suited to it.
Yeah.
And, I think I was very fortunate to work with the people I work with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to work with Peckinpah, Billy Wilder, Ken Russell, Dickie Attenborough, John Glenn, and the wonderful Richard Donner, who I did, you know, three films with. You know, it's been a privileged existence.
Yeah.
And, you know, here I am at the delicate age of 76 still doing night work. Can you believe it?
Can I quickly ask, you know, obviously it might be a bit sort of difficult for you to sort of detach yourself from the films that you've worked on, but of the Bond series, you mentioned that Octopussy, you're very proud of the work you did in that, but across the series as a whole, is there a particular Bond film that you love as a cinema lover, you know, as a film goer? Is there something that
a particular one I hate?
Oh, right.
Go, please tell us that too.
Yes, please tell us.
Oh, Another Day.
Right, okay. We're currently reviewing that at the moment, so any insight would be very interesting.
Well, an invisible car. Bond surfing.
Well, yeah, the surfing, yeah, these are all the common,
That whole plane sequence, which had to be the way it was written, CGI.
Mm.
It was just the story. I don't think it gave any of us any chance to do what is Bond. And I think, you know, it was led to a degree by visual effects saying they could do things that they couldn't.
Mm. Yep.
I know it was just the wrong combination. But for me, it's the only Bond I've ever worked on that I've not been particularly proud of the effects work that I was responsible for.
It must be very frustrating to see, you know, like you say, there's so much. And I think I think it's fair to say that, you know, the Bond films, if you get beyond, you know, how its cultural kind of impact and the fact, you know, it's Bond and it traveling the world and all those kind of things, what appeals to so many people is how practical it is, you know, in terms of, if it always feels very, very, very grounded, you know, the stunts, obviously actually doing it for real is often part of the marketing. Well, it certainly used to be. And the same with like model making, you know, and I do feel it's, and I know that some of the last films have still continue to use obviously miniatures and models, but I think it's fair to say that for a long period of time, the Bond films were almost sold as being, you know, these films, the height of the craft, like you say, regardless of what department it was, it was the height of
that. And yet, strangely, if you look back at the history of Bonds, there have been very few Academy Award nominations.
Yeah, shocking.
Let's not talk about that. you know, it's rather silly when you think about it.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the other Bonds that I did really enjoy, again, partly because of the director, Michael Apted, who was a lovely man, was Twine.
Yeah, and, great film.
You know, the things that we did on that with the, you know, submarine shooting out in the Bahamas, you know, everybody thinks, oh, off to the Bahamas, you know, on a jolly. it was lovely. We had a nice hotel, had its own golf course, if you ever got the time to play on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we were going out to sea every day. We had sea lice to contend with. We had fish that latched themselves onto the model, thinking the model was a bigger fish. So we were forever chasing them off. We had sharks swimming by while we were doing it. You know, we were 120 feet down. and we were what were we, about 100 feet away from the Atlantic drop-off, where it just went down 3,000 feet.
Oh, my word.
I'd got this big boat that we were using as a mothership, had the ability to lift the model in and out of the water. I mean, the model weighed several tons and it was 60-odd feet long.
Yeah.
It had its own flotation in it and motors and air things and whatever. But we still had to control it and keep it on wires for safety. And whenever we broke for lunch, I'd make sure or ask the divers to put the safety tethers on it and pull it in, hang it under the mothership. One day we broke for lunch and we were up on the deck and I said to the divers, you did put the safeties on the model, didn't you, when we came up? And they all sort of went pale and looked at one another.
Oh, no.
Looked over the side. And there was the model bouncing along the bottom, going towards the drop-off.
Oh, no.
If it had gone over the edge, I mean, we'd have lost. I hate to think what would have happened.
Yes.
And you've never seen five guys put air tanks on so quickly. I mean, I think I was the first one down there. And I managed to get hold of the front of the sub and dig my heels in the sand while the rest of them got ropes and cables over. And we pulled it back and made it safe. But scary little moments like that do make life more interesting sometimes.
How was the boat chase in Twine? Because we love Twine, it's great fun, but the miniature boat and then the actual sorting the sequence out, the product's incredible. How was it for you guys in special effects? The boat chase on the Thames?
Well, that was all done for real. The only model that was involved in that was I had a very small model that we fired out of the MI6 building that started the sequence off.
Stop! Stop! It isn't finished! Stop!
After that, it was all real boats.
Yeah.
Racing up and down, and then we did the balloon over the Millennium Dome.
Yeah.
That blowing up. That we did a lot of model boat stuff on Tomorrow Never Dies as well.
Yeah. Oh,
the dark boat and the stealth boat and the frigate which sank, and we shot that all in the Titanic tank in Rosarito.
Yeah. Oh, wow!
Again, you know, sort of challenging underwater stuff, but quite fun to do.
I mean, just listening to you, I'm not just saying this, you're like a real life James Bond, John. You know, if you're not underwater, you're driving cars at 75 miles an hour with airplanes on top of them. It's absolutely incredible.
Well, I'd say it's sort of a bit of a privileged life, really. I can't say I haven't had fun along the way.
What would you say, I mean, all across the body, beyond Bond, what film are you most proud, I suppose, proud of your work on?
I ask that question every single time I'm interviewed. There is never a straight answer to it
because
I'm proud of so many films for so many different reasons.
Yeah.
Some of them were just fun to work on. Some of them were, shall we say, a little more challenging because of the director involved. I did three films on the trot many years ago when I was quite young in my 20s. One was The Devils with Ken Russell, who could be inclined to shout and scream and lose his temper a bit. I loved him, really. And I always found the best way with directors like that is to shout back. You either stay on the film or you don't, but either way, you don't get shouted at. But Ken was lovely. Peckinpah was a very interesting director to work with. Hard man. Yeah. Enjoyed his alcohol and stuff. Could be difficult. Yeah. I showed him a load of tests at the beginning of the movie, and he said, Jesus Christ, kid, where were you? I needed you on the Wild Bunch. You know, I did a movie called Lucky Lady with Stanley Donen. Yeah. I did several films with Stanley, lovely man. And, you know, he directed Singing in the Rain and so many great movies. And, you know, working at sea on boats for 6 months in the Gulf of Mexico, blowing boats up left, right and centre with Gene Hackman, Burt Reynolds and Liza Minnelli.
So
I was 27, 28, and a lot of the crew and all the stuntmen were from Hollywood. And, it was, Jesus, who is this limey kid? It was a challenging movie. I always loved it for that reason.
Yeah.
The Bonds were challenging. The Potter films, you know, I did all eight of those, but they weren't as much fun to do, but we've still ended up with a... So, yeah, I mean, the first four Harry Potters for me are still the best. And it was... I don't think anybody ever gave Chris Columbus, the director, the kudos, because he set the whole thing up for all the directors that followed. You know, the casting, the look, the everything. And they were really special. But, you know, as a series of eight movies, they're classics. So, you know, I'm quite pleased and proud to have been part of those. I did a bunch of films. I worked in Hollywood lived out there for 14 years. And, you know, some of those were hard going. Working with Paul Verhoeven on Starship Troopers was challenging, to say the least. But, you know, managed to get through them all. So,
absolutely.
You know, there's a lot of movies. The Omen, again, you know, working with Richard Donner and chopping people's heads off. Again, I had a crew of two or three of us. But, you know, for that, we built all the rigs. We, you know, came up with the ideas. We did everything on the movie. And I think the whole special effects budget, including salaries, was something like £22,000 on The Omen, you know.
Yeah.
So different films for different reasons is the answer.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, you're an Oscar winning special.
Well, six nominations, only one win. But I was unfortunate for when Cliffhanger was up, we were up against the first Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And when Troopers were up, we were up against Titanic.
Yeah.
Did
they deserve it over us?
Yeah.
Tell you what, Octopussy deserved it in 1983, that's for sure.
Yes.
But we thank you so much for your time, John. It's really kind. We recognise that you're an incredibly busy man. It really means a lot to us that, you know, we can hear some of the stories of just a snippet of your career. Thank you so much.
Thank you for sharing some of these amazing stories with us.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Thanks so much for your time. Pleasure. Lovely to meet you. Take care.
Really the worst.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.